Okay, so welcome back and welcome to this our regular morning share. This week we're going to be focusing on something which is contemporary, something which just has been in the news recently, and something which obviously has been on people's minds. A lot of people have come to me and mentioned that this particular issue is something which has been concerning them. And so I wanted to respond. I wanted to give a little bit of thought together to this particular issue. And that is the notion of a number of comments which were made a few weeks ago by Seth Rogen, actor, director. And the topic of this show really is the tragedy of a long golos, the tragedy of a long exile, and understanding where these comments came from and trying to appreciate our perspective, our role in this trajectory, in this spectrum. So let's start at the very beginning. This is, I'm sure, I have no doubt that people have been following this particular story as it unfolded over the course of the week. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to just think a little bit with you. I'm going to share screen, but feel free to let me know if there's a problem. Last week was a little more complicated just setting the share screen, but here we go. Just put together a little bit of a audio visual on this. So just a few weeks ago, Seth Rogen was just actually last week he released a movie called The American Pickle. Which was actually which is an excellent movie, and he was on a particular he was on a podcast with Marc Maron called Waiting for the Punch, and he said what is interesting is that there's a number of things that he said which raised people's eyebrows. So the most famous quote which got people concerned was a quote about Israel. He believed that he was miseducated about Israel. He believed that he was ultimately the victim of what he called brainwashing. Now, I personally wasn't so challenged by the comments that he made for a number of reasons. First reason is that up till now, Seth Rogen really never featured in my life too much, and the reason is because I don't know. For me, role models are people who actually have values, who represent certain higher ideas, who live lifestyles reflecting those. In society that we have around us, interestingly enough, we have given a certain sense the totem pole has been to the people who are at the highest, apex of society is those who are the most successful. What's the most success in a society governed by entertainment is those who are entertainers, who are successful entertainers, who have a lot of money and who have the ability to have the public ear because, or eye, because of their involvement in the entertainment industry. But to be quite honest, that hasn't quite made the cut on my side necessarily because to a certain degree, the fact that this particular person does happen to have a lot of money and public standing doesn't necessarily mean to me that they have value or content necessarily internally. I mean, so the people that I look to as role models are people who actually have lives led by values, and this is not necessarily the same. Now, at the same time, it is concerning because he does have the ear of millions. There's no question of that. But in terms of personally, he didn't represent anything of great value necessarily before or after this, for me to be particularly concerned. But for the second reason is as well, if you listen to the actual podcast, it's worthwhile listening to if you can manage to swallow all the expletives. And he was actually a comedian, so he's like joking around a lot of the time. And his comments certainly about Israel were taken very very much out of context. What he was just basically saying was that he had more of a it was more complex than he was actually educated for it to be. However, the way he put it was, so to speak, that particular line was taken by many people and taken out of context and became the platform for many people to manipulate and use in a way which has actually created much public uproar in a way that I don't think he personally intended. So for these two reasons, I wasn't particularly concerned about what he was actually saying. However, if you actually listen to the actual podcast where he talks about his Judaism and his upbringing, there was more to be concerned. Now, again, he's not a scholar. He's not a person who's writing down a doctoral thesis. He's simply a man on a podcast trying to push his most recent movie, right? So you can't be maniacal in every single word that he says. But in general, what concerned me more than the specifically Israel comment was a general sense of where American Jewry is today. That was really what to me was much more concerning is the state of American Jewry as a whole, because we should realize that although we in the Orthodox camp, you know, have very vibrant institutions and communities and so on, we are less than 20% of American Jewry as of now. And that means to say that a vast majority are going to have opinions or perspectives like him, and it's worthwhile understanding that and getting a drink, you know, so to speak, smelling the coffee a little bit and understanding where American Jewry is. So before even getting there to his comments, I just want to actually just to get a sense of this podcast is actually about his movie. This is actually what he was trying to push it, and it was a very fascinating movie. I just wonder for a quick second, I'm going to share the trailer to this movie because it's worthwhile understanding what he was trying to do, and it's actually a very, very, very thought-provoking movie. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick look at this. I hope that we can see this over here. If I'm going to put on the screen here, if there is a problem seeing this, please interrupt and please let me know. But this is going to just take 2 minutes to appreciate what he was trying to achieve, and then let's reflect on that.
Als ik zo opzal in mijn eigen moet zijn.
Oeh, in old country of Slupske, I am a ditch digger. As far as jobs in Slupske go, it's pretty good. We are the Greenbounds, and we have American dream. I find good job in Pico Factory. Sarah, I make this vow. 100 years, our family will prosper. And then one day, everything changed.
It's been 100 years. The pickle brine preserved him perfectly.
It's well to do that. The world has changed. Everyone I know is gone.
We were able to track down a great-grandson.
Greenbaum? This is nuts.
Walk past the cafe that you don't need when you've lived in...
Your parents, where are they? They passed away. It was a car crash. He will tell me everything of their deaths, how their bodies died, their faces as the life left. We will bond over our pain.
Oh, no, love, you're not alone.
I understand why you're a religious person, but I'm not.
How do you grieve for dead parents?
You're okay.
I have an idea. Is that Pico business?
That's a very stupid idea, Herschel.
You have no life, no children, no friends, no job.
You need help.
I'm fine.
You're not alone.
You will become success.
Wow.
Ooh. Very pungent.
Yeah, that's straight from the devil.
We'll finally make their parents bow. Don't talk about my parents. You never met them.
You have captivated the hearts of the entire world.
Probably not best case scenario for the families become.
In old country,
we have saying. I'm sure this has aged well.
If man does not throw punch, it is because this man secretly had polio arm. Do something then. Throw your punch.
You know they cured polio, right? A guy named Jonas Salk.
Was he Jew?
He was.
Yes.
Okay. Also, we'll stop the trailer here. So this is what was actually released just last week, August 6th. So his response, he is actually trying to push this forward. It's fascinating, really, just a fascinating movie. I took the time out to actually watch it before commenting, because it's much more important to actually understand what's going on before you comment on it. I listened to the podcast, I watched the movie. It was really excellently done. And what concerned me more in the podcast was actually more about his perspective on Jewish education and the way that he was brought up. He describes that something, he had a moment of an epiphany where he came back from Hebrew school, and his sister, who was 3 years older than him, said to him, like, you know, hey, like, with like, you know, barring all the expletives, says, hey, you know, nobody, you know, mom and dad don't really care about this, you know, like, this stuff really is just like all fairy tales, right? You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're learning about all this stuff and nobody really does it, right? So mom and dad don't do it at home. And it was like an epiphany for him. It's like all those stories they were telling him, they were nice, but like, you know, it was okay. He also talks about what was concerning is that he describes his Jewish education, which obviously was something very minimal, as being something which he called brainwashing, meaning not being forced to think things without having the opportunity to decide about them, which is a fascinating way to describe being told a minimal amount of knowledge. And he was also describing how he didn't have really a choice in what he had to believe in until he grew more mature and realized this was all nonsense. And at the end, he does come around and he says, you know, that there are aspects of Judaism which are useful, he calls them. You know, not divine or important or, you know, from a higher order, but they're useful. Like the Shiva process, or when his wife was going through something, the idea that this was actually pretty well thought out, you know, how to grieve, and, you know, there's something to it. So these are the descriptions of, so to speak, where he stands. So, you know, religion being somewhat useful at certain stations in life, but most of it really being nonsense, really being something which was brainwashing and something which people don't really care about or believe in. To me, that this is more concerning about the state of the average American Jew, more than it does necessarily about the specific comments about Israel, which there were many responses to. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Benjamin Blech wrote a very beautiful open letter on Aish, if you had a chance to read it, to him, and offered actually to, after a very beautiful description, to learn with him. And I think that would be a great opportunity. If anybody received an invitation from Rabbi Blech to learn with him, they should take it with two hands. It's a great opportunity. But the question, I guess, from my side is, how did we get here? Like, I mean, you say, how did American Jews, and this is not just American Jews, who could reverse now, you know, 80, 90 years and get to German Jews? How was it that we arrived at French Jews before that? How did we get you in the first place? So just it takes me back just to a fascinating perspective shared by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe, this is actually it's recorded in a number of Haggadahs. I actually saw this personally, Rabbi Riskin's Haggadah on the four sons. And he says that the four sons, the Arba Bonim that are talked about in the Haggadah, are in fact four generations. Four generations, and it's very much reflective of what was being described in the American Pickle, and that's why it's so fascinating, is the first generation comes from a different country. They come, they speak a different language, they're a chacham. They have the tradition, they have the practice, they have the involvement in a traditional version of Judaism. They live that life. They're foreign to the culture around them, but their son, the son that they have in the new country, is not interested. He goes to public school, he learns the language, he's much more sophisticated than the folks his parents hang out with. He's not interested in the little shtibble they grow up in. He's going to go places, he's going to get a degree, he's going to get a job. He throws the tefillin off, he's not interested in all of this. He asks, Dad, Mom, why are you wasting your time with all this backwards, antiquated, anachronistic nonsense? And off he goes into the new world, becomes a success in the new country. And then he has a son, and that this new generation, you know, he goes to work on Shabbos, and he has a son. This son's a Tam. This son's a little bit, you know, confused, because, you know, on the one hand, you know, his dad and his mom have nothing to do with this religion, you know, religious nonsense. But his grandparents, on the other hand, seem to be very involved in something which their parents aren't. So this poor little Tom grows up and he says, you know, Mazah, it's like, what is this? Like, you know, when he thinks about candles, he has a distant memory of grandma who used to light candles on a Friday afternoon. Right? But on the other hand, you know, Judaism means not much more than cream cheese and bagels. And that's kind of where the third generation lives. And then there's the fourth generation. Nebuch, the fourth generation, hasn't seen grandma lighting candles, grandfather davening and knowing how to say Kaddish. The fourth generation is unfortunately Nebuch, she'ena yodea lishol. Has so little left of what was. It doesn't have the connection even to grandfather and grandmother, in this case, great-grandfather and great-grandmother. There is very little left of what the tradition is. Says the Lubavitcher Rebbe, these are four stages in the, so to speak, assimilation process of Jews in whichever country they come to. We've been witnessing it recently in America. But nonetheless, this is the truth in most situations. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe famously says that the fifth generation is the child who's not even at the table. So it's not as that there is a she'ani adelishol. He's not even the time. He actually isn't even interested in coming to the Seder anymore. There's no longer the family gathering around, you know, around bagels and cheese on Pesach, right? That doesn't even exist anymore. And that's the tragedy of what we're witnessing unfold in front of us. We're at this point in time in American Jewry, we're, you know, between generation 4 and 5 for the vast majority of American Jews. And that's where we stand. That's a terrifying thought. And in a certain sense, what Seth was doing with this movie was really an excellent rendition, is that development. And yes, the fourth generation is somewhat still connected. He does remember Hebrew in Hebrew school, but that's about it. So he's still in the Shana Delish, or maybe even Tam side of things. But let's take a little bit further as well. You know, it is interesting that if you think about the movie itself, which is a short movie, it's almost in a certain, you know, I would say it's an attempted Fiddler on the Roof Part 2, if you think about it. It's, you know, Fiddler on the Roof was Judaism in Eastern Europe confronting issues like communism, anti-Semitism, assimilation, intermarriage, right? There were certain elements of that which were being explored in Fiddler on the Roof, traditionalism versus the new isms. And it leaves off as the Jews are running from their town after being expelled from Anatevka. And what they make the decision, they know they're going to go to Chicago, if you remember at the end of the movie. They're going to go out to the Golden Medina, and that's where they're going to go to America. And in a certain sense, so to speak, this movie, so to speak, is the follow-up. It's the sequel to Fiddler on the Roof. But what is fascinating to me about it is both in Fiddler on the Roof and the American Pickle is that the generation that's described as the traditional one, there's no religious content to their lives. What's fascinating? There's no religious content to their lives. When you look at Tevye in the Fiddler on the Roof, and you look at this individual, the most thing that matters to him is tradition, not necessarily religion. Tradition. The rendition of Shalom Aleichem of this poor Tevye is the perspective of the traditional religious Jew from the outside. It's not the richness of life. It's not living what a Torah lifestyle looks like. The closest you get in Fiddler on the Roof is perhaps the bracha on Friday night. May the Lord protect you, right? That's the closest to something religious. But and perhaps superstition and tradition. But there's no actual description of living what a religious life is when it comes to Tevye himself. And similarly in this. This film, in a certain sense, is portraying two different nodes. The node of traditionalism versus progressivism, which Seth actually said in a later podcast as a follow-up, or an interview as a follow-up to this podcast. Traditionalism and progressivism and how to put the two together, the great-grandfather and the great-grandson, and living in the same box. But there's no actual reflection on real religion. The only religious experience he has is saying Kaddish, or remembering that he could say Kaddish when he was saying it for his parents 5 years later. And if you think about that, that's exactly what Seth was saying on the podcast. Is there's aspects of the religion which are useful? There's nothing intrinsically meaningful necessarily. It's useful. And if you think about that, it's an unfair portrayal of what a real religious lifestyle is. Herschel, in this particular movie, who's the Tevye of the previous movie, in a certain sense is so to speak, this traditional Jew, lives with traditional values and traditional perspectives, which in modern America are insulting to many. But if you think about it to a certain degree, there never was a portrayal of what a real living Torah lifestyle was, because the people making it never experienced that in the first place. They don't understand what it's like to live within the bubble, to have the richness of life of a religious lifestyle. And so therefore, it may be tradition versus progressivism, but it's certainly not religion or a religious lifestyle, because they simply don't have access to it. It's fascinating how much time the liberal modern Jews of America spend time talking about those who are religious without actually knowing from the inside what it is. And it's very easy to write a commentary on what the religious Jews are doing without actually knowing what it's like to be a religious Jew, or what it's like to live that lifestyle, because you simply don't have the ability. And you can write as many satires as you want, but you'll never be able to access it from the inside. Where did this all start? Where did this all start? So interestingly enough, this is not a new phenomenon. We have much, much history to garner from to appreciate this. And, Mark Maron in the interview actually said, you know, like, one of the interesting things about Jewish education as a conservative Jew was you know real relationship to God. You know, like, unlike Yoshka, where, you know, you kind of know you worship him in a certain way because he's going to atone for your sins. In Judaism, like, there's no real relationship to God. Seth Rogen said, like, yeah, it's like kind of like the tooth fairy. You know, it's like you're taught and you kind of believe it at the time, and you know it isn't really real. So where did this all begin from? So it's really fascinating. I would highly, highly recommend reading Rav Hirsch's has an essay in the Collected Writings on Av. It's the second essay on Av. It is so essentially necessary to read, because it's not like we're here in America and this is the first time this is happening. This has all happened beforehand, right? In Germany, in the 1800s, when Rav Hirsch was establishing his community, he was dealing with people from the Reform who were slowly but surely taking out, siphoning out any life from traditional religious Judaism. And he writes about this. And actually, I didn't include in the sources over here, but he describes it based on the Medrash in Parashas Bechukai. The Medrash describes seven stages of the devolution to apostasy. And he talks about it first, the person stops learning Torah. But they carry on practicing. Are we going to carry on practicing? I don't need to like commit all the time to learning. And then after a while, what happens is when you stop learning about it, slowly you start making mistakes and practices fall by the wayside. And once the practices fall by the wayside, you start scorning those who do practice. And once you start scorning those who do practice, you start hating those who teach it. And once you start hating those who teach it, then you start getting in the way of those who want to perform it. And then you slowly deny Sinai and you deny actual God himself. And he describes these seven stages based on the Gemara. This is actually a Medrash in Parshas Bechukai. So, and he goes through and articulates how each stage has occurred in society around. I'd like to just quote, this is not in the source, but I'd like to just quote for a second one of the paragraphs where he talks about this is the stage of scorning those who perform. He says, he describes how those who, this is obviously an earlier stage than the fourth generation American necessarily, but it's an earlier stage which is important to appreciate because it helps us understand where we get here. This person cannot criticize the fact that there are those who are religious Jews who sacrifice, who are resolute, who are honest. So they can't criticize that aspect of it. He says he must persuade himself that his sophisms, his brand of wisdom, and his apostasy constitute progress, and his dissoluteness constitutes freedom. He must convince himself that the law was clearly not given to him, that it was not given to men of breeding and discernment such as he, nor to men of his social rank, nor to men who possess whatever other superb qualities he ascribes to himself. He must convince himself that the divine law would have no significance or value in the Olympian realms where his intellect dwells. In short, contemptuous towards Torah restrictions enacted by God, he must climb to the levels of which the divine warning refers in Bechukai Timosul. There he removes all the drivel from the divine law until it can be easily perceived as that much of the law as anachronistic, until it is obvious that this irrelevant material is valuable only to those who have not yet mentally escaped from underneath the Egyptian burden of bricks, or for those who still breathe the oppressive air of godless and medieval darkness. He declares that all this irrelevant material might have been a beneficial and necessary in former times, but certainly cannot be any use to the free man. There on his sublime heights, the intellectual rabble are separated from the intellectual patricians, and the law, which was dictated by God, is left to the intellectually impoverished, the uneducated, and the ignorant. This is stage three, actually, Rav Hirsch is describing of this process. Where does this all start from? It all stems from, says Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. And this is the conclusion of his essay on Tisha B'Av. On the ninth of Av, on the day of fasting and mourning, the sound of lamentation reaches us from the ruins of Yerushalayim. Al Ma'av da Oretz, right? Echo Yashab Adad, Ha'ir of Asiyam. And we say in lamentation, there's a cry of anguish. Chet Chata Yerushalayim Al Kain Lindidai Hayasa. He says, this carnal transgression was not the neglect of the temple and the sacrifices. It was not indifference to the divine service and ceremony. The cardinal transgression was the sin which is the root of all evil, the one which evoked the nameless lamentation. The sin was the neglect of Torah study. It was the distracted ignorance of God's law, the ignorance which causes the mind and the heart, the places where thought and action originate, to remain untouched by the light and the power of divine word, and fall prey to error and delusion, and then recklessness and passion. This was the destructive ignorance through which the Jewish people's minds and hearts became so preoccupied with every aspect of living except the fulfillment of God's will. So Rav Hirsch says, if you want to understand where it all stems from, understand the first of the seven steps before you get to the end of the seven steps, and that is when you stop learning Torah, when you stop being involved, being immersed in it, then you simply, the next step will be practice, and then scorning, and then hating, and then standing in the way of divine service. These are all natural progressive steps, and we're witnessing the end of the line in a certain sense, but it's important to appreciate where it starts from. And for ourselves, it's important to have a moment of self-reflection here, because this is a commentary on American Jewry, so to speak, that has really traveled quite far. But to a certain degree, we're also on that spectrum. And we have to ask ourselves, in a certain sense, is in order to avoid this, in order for our children, our grandchildren to avoid this, let's not make the mistakes that Rav Hirsch is talking about in this Midrash. Understand that learning and actually practicing Judaism has to be at the center point of our lives in order for this to actually for us not to fall prey to the next steps. This is a very important step. But let's take one step further. It is interesting to me that there is a pattern over here. The American Pickle describes a four-generation pattern. The traditionalist whose son is a foreman, whose son is an accountant, whose son is a software developer, right? That's kind of like the development moving away from why I understand respectfully why you're religious, but ultimately I'm not religious, right? That kind of perspective. Well, there is another description of a four-generation gap, which should be well known to us, but it's worthwhile appreciating. This is from Ramea Simcha Dvinsk. He wrote this in his sefer called Mishe Chochmar, which was written over a century ago, and we're talking about in Eastern Europe. And it's important to understand the pattern he describes over here, a pattern which unfortunately has not yet been disproved. Not yet been disproved, which should be cause for great concern for us. Here's what he says. It's also in Parashas B'chukosai. Why Parashas B'chukosai? Because it talks about the curses. Here's what Rav Meir Simcha says. Kachi darko shel ha'uma. This is the way of the nation. Sheka'asher yikonsu le'eretz nachriya. When they enter a foreign land, which we have done. We have gone through every foreign land almost on this planet. I don't think there's yet a Chabad in Antarctica. But other than that, I think we've really done it all. Right? We've been to all the countries around. You ain't b'nei Torah. They start at the beginning. They're not b'nei Torah. Kasher nidal dulumin atzoras agzeros agirush, because of all the pain and suffering of being expelled of the previous country. V'achakoch yisarer bom ruach eloki hashoef bom la'ashivam lemekor chotzvo lemachzeves kotcham. And then they are inspired perhaps to return to somewhat of their root. Yelamdu, they'll learn yarbitzu Torah. They will establish Torah institutions. Yasu niflois. Ad ki amod keren haTorah al rumoy v'siyah. And some part of that, and by the way, this is a fraction of society, will reestablish certain speak Torah Jewry to a certain degree. Halo em be yada dorah chadosh lo yisifma. And then there's not so much more to even add. Liz goder neged avoysam. Ma yaseh chefetz ha'adam ha'asui leizkareru lechadesh. Yivakeh barayim kozevas asher nichilu avoseinu. So then, the new generation is not as interested in that. They want to be progressive. They want to get to the next step. So they try to say, well, what is it? What is it we can add? What's better in the society? Yesha, and they'll look into false ideas. Yeshaer chadoshos, right? I apologize. Yeah. Bishkoyach ma haya leumasai bisnadu b'yam agam his hamhat lois. And they forget what led us to all these vicissitudes of time. V'yihiyema od ma'at yeshuv lamar sheken anchu anachlo avosen. And it won't be too long before the new generations will say, ah, all that stuff, that traditionalism, that retrograde stuff, is not for us. By Yisraeli bichlal yishkach machtzavov, they'll forget where their foundation, where their quarry is. V'yachshav le'ezrach ra'anan, and they'll become a fresh new citizen of the new world, the new order, the new intellectual order. Yazo limudo datit, he'll leave his, so to speak, his religious learning, lilmod l'shanoi sloiloi, to learn new languages. Yolav mi mekalkalto v'lo yolav mi takanta. They'll learn from, first speak, broken systems rather than fixed systems. Yashov ki berlin hi Yerushalayim. Ukumukul kolim shibohem asisem. I actually skipped between one and the other. I apologize. These are the two sources. He will think that Berlin is Jerusalem, and he will adopt the most negative of practices. Don't be so excited about how sophisticated you become as a German Jew, says the Meir Simcha. A storm will come, and it will uproot you from where you were established. And you'll be pushed in another nation where you don't know its language and you'll clearly be a foreigner. I apologize. I moved together these two sources. The first column actually describes that every 100 or 200 years, as the nation of Israel, so to speak, gets entrenched in this new culture, becomes involved in their culture, forgets the baggage of their previous culture that they were kicked out of, another storm will come and pick them up and throw them to a new culture, and they'll have to reestablish themselves. It'll be 100, 200 years in each culture, which is a pretty accurate assessment in most of the Jewish communities or vibrant Jewish communities around the world. There isn't such a long runway in their involvement. And he's actually talking right now about the sophisticated, so to speak, German Jew at this point in time. And remember, this is said well before the 1920s even, just to understand this. He says the storm wind is going to be coming, and that storm wind will reestablish you in a new place. And he was right on mark. He was exactly on mark. That was, though he couldn't have expected precisely what this was. He had passed away by the time the Holocaust had actually come. But he was describing a certain pattern that he sees in history. And this is what Parshas Bechukah is articulating, that there is this movement. We come to a new place, we establish the traditional institutions, the new generation is not interested in traditionalism, they're interested in progressivism, they start progressing into that society, they get entrenched in society, a new stormwind comes, reminds them that they're Jews, put in a new place, and the cycle begins again. And hopefully we survive, we advance. Hopefully we learn from this. So I think it's also important, you know, the American pickle is one way of looking at things, and that's one way of looking at four generations. But I would say let's think about the fifth and sixth generation. Let's try to think about, without being alarmist, but, you know, if you ask a German Jew in the 1920s, you know, could you imagine anything being wrong over here? I would say we've ascended to the highest echelons of society. We become so integrated. We have people. We have Jews who are respected. Olympic trophies, scientific advances through German Jews, medals of honor in World War I. Why would they think otherwise? Why would they? They become involved in the society to such a large degree. Well, we should realize that that has been the pattern of all societies, whether it be the Spanish Jews or the French Jews or the English Jews. All of them, when the Jews were expelled from England, although they were expelled from France numerous times. They all look the same thing at that point in time. Just understand this process over here. It's important to understand the pattern of the generation, says the Mishnah Chochmah. Let's take it one step further. One thing which was fascinating to me in this whole description in the podcast was also when Seth and Mark described anti-Semitism. You know, it was fascinating because, you know, it's on everybody's mind, and Seth admits that he spent a lot of time actually thinking about this. And he points out, you know, that his dad said to him, you know, I'm very glad, he was actually very glad his father told him, listen, just know, son, that everybody hates Jews, right? And he said he's very happy because otherwise he'd spend his life being surprised at all the kinds of nonsense that people say to him all the time as being a Jew. And so Mark Maron suggested in his infinite wisdom that the reason why that there was anti-Semitism was because Jews were never allowed to participate in the regular professions, and they got professions which gave them charge, so to speak, of people's monies, and that made people upset over time, which is one common, so to speak, you know, pretty vanilla reason for anti-Semitism until it no longer holds up. And Seth suggested that, no, it's because we're different. People don't like people who are different. Or even if you look the same, you believe something else. So the more different you look, the more they hate you. The more differently you believe or think, the more they would hate you. Right? So therefore, if you're to, so to speak, think about those two arguments about anti-Semitism, these are not, you know, revolutionary ideas. If you think about those ideas, so that how do you fix that? So the answer would be is if the problem is that, you know, so to speak, we're too different, right? So what's the resolution? This is a very simple resolution, folks. So let's be like them and they'll stop hating us, right? Right? Which is, seems to be where this is going. So I'd like to quote a fascinating comment which was made by Rav Elchanan Wasserman HaYashem Yekom Domo, who was murdered by Lithuanian Kabbalah collaborators at the beginning of the Holocaust. And what is interesting is his comment over here which is recorded in his Sefer Koibetz Ma'amarim. Now this is very harsh, so I have to just, you know, this is so to speak a warning before we witness this. But I think we can stomach this. It's important. These are important topics. Let's this is the shorter version of what he says. Here's what Rav Elchanan says. Remember, Rav Elchanan is living in Eastern Europe. He's living in Lithuania, the height of European Jewry in the yeshivas. There are thousands of people learning Torah in the Hasidic world, in the Litvish world, and he's also witnessing the devolution of Jewry, so to speak, under various aspects, whether it be the Haskalah or secular Zionism or communism. And he's witnessing all of this, and this is his comment he makes. It's a short paragraph called Nihye Kagoyim, we're going to be like the nations. And here's what he says. Everybody can stomach this. Yechezkel Nuva, in the 20th chapter of Perek of Yechezkel, it's described, Ki be'ikus de Mashiach yachrizo al sisma. There'll be a statement which is made at the times of Mashiach, Nihye Kagoyim. We want to be like the nations of the world. Hanavuah hischila lizkashem lifnei 150 shana al yedei noisei haskalas Berlin. He says the Haskalah, the reform movement, as it started in Germany and Berlin, was the beginnings of the people who said maybe we can resolve things by being like the nations of the world. Histiru es hasisma tachas mimra haye yehudi ba'alecha va'adam betzei secha. The way they so to speak euphemized that statement of in Yechezkel, which was what the Zakenim said to Yechezkel at the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, was, I said, be a Jew in your tent and a man in the street, right? Meaning to say, conform to society as you walk out. Lo yarchu hayomim. Didn't take too long, he says. Upriya shita azu gamalu bishel. It didn't take too long for the product of this to ripen. Habonim himriru estatam. The children ultimately sacrificed their religion. They sacrificed their practice. V'sisma zu, in this statement, because it ultimately it undermined the essence of what the Torah is supposed to be. Torah hizira sayudim al his badlus hagumura bekol orach chayim me'amim asher sivu seihem. The Torah talks about insulation, being separate. Vavdil eschem and amim liyasli. Hashem says, I want you to be separate for me, right? Vamaskilim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds in Yechezkel to the people at the times of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. Now he says, I will ensure that you won't be like the Goyim. How? Because with a strong hand, an outstretched arm, and with unmitigated anger, I will pour it upon you, and I will rule upon you, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu to these people who asked Yechezkel this. So explains Rabbi Yochanan, Hashem Yisborach Yaschil B'yad Chazakah, Im Ha'am Ya'amod B'merdai, Tavoy Azra Natsuya, Im Yosef Ha'am Leches Bekeri, Tavoy Ha'am Shufuqa. These are three stages that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring upon the nation of Israel in order to rectify their behavior pattern. Now, he doesn't say this here, because this is the shortened version of this, but if you actually read the longer version of this in Kabetz Mamorim, it's pretty terrifying. He describes what each of these three stages are. Beyad Chazakai talks about pogroms. Zrayin Atuya talks about sickness and epidemics. And then he says somewhat terrifyingly, prophetically, he says, the Chema Shafucha, this outpouring of wrath, he says, we don't know what it will look like. He says, but it is coming. And it'll be so terrifying, we have no idea what it'll even look like, says Rabbi Elchanan. Right? So he says, and he describes that the level of anti-Semitism which was rising in Eastern and across Europe at that time was so unnatural, he said that it's coming, I can see something is in the air. That's what Rabbi Elchanan was saying. Just understand what he's saying. He says, why? That's the third stage of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's recourse to the people's response by saying, Nia Kagoyim. Just understand where he's coming from. He says now further, Ein ladas le'ezer min ha'shlosh ha'malchos higanu hayom. He says, we don't know where we are right now. This is an earlier version of this. Ha'asila korov yachiyach lanu ezos. The near future will prove to us, and unfortunately it did. He was a victim of that. B'chol oifen baruru, it's nonetheless it's clear, ki nevois ha'yod lo yisyeh hiskashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is showing us that the idea of niyeh kagoyim, let us be like the nations, is not going to work out so well. Hagoyim megarshim osanu migvulam. The nations, the Gentiles, chase us from their areas. Maragol b'fiyo olam ki kosher liyos yudei. People say, it's so hard to be a Jew. Hinei nishtanu ayd ni'itzim. He says times have changed. Bizman acharon kosher pi sheva liyudi liyos goy. It's much harder for a Jew to be like a Gentile today. Hagoyim sholchim osan me'al panehem. They throw us out. B'shem agon bal beis alevi zel. He quotes from Soloveitchik, who says, Oimrim. We resound on what's the Shabbos. HaKadosh Baruch Hu divides between light and dark, between Israel and the nations. We know that there's a boundary between night and day. Right? There's twilight. You can't. No human being can adjust daylight and night time. He says, "Gam ben Yisrael la'amim yesh merchak yadua u'mavdil b'neim." There's also a division between Israel and the nations. When the Jews decide that they want to be just a little closer because they want to dilute that difference and all those antiquated separations, they push her back because it's a natural division. They say, there's a famous statement which is that if the Jews are not willing to make Kiddush, the nations of the world will make Havdalah. Which is a certain way that's being said over here. And it's important to realize, it's really important to have this perspective, is we are not living this experience the first time round. we have the great benefit of looking back at history and seeing what happens after a while, or seeing what it looks like to cozy up to a little too much, to be involved with the illusion, with the delusion that ultimately, Nia Kagoyim, that if we weren't so different, they would love us. And it hasn't worked. It didn't work. And it's not working now either. You know who came to this conclusion as well? We don't have to be a rocket scientist to appreciate this. There was an individual who noticed this as well. His name was Theodor Herzl. And it really pays to read history, because otherwise we are ultimately going to be slated to relive it. Theodor Herzl was not a religious man. And he was a journalist, worked in Western Europe. And he said a very, very fascinating thing. And this is from the Jewish Encyclopedia, just a quote. Herzl first encountered anti-Semitism that would shape his life and the fate of the Jews of the 20th century while studying the University of Vienna. Later, during his stay in Paris as a journalist, he was brought face to face with the problem. At the time, he regarded the Jewish problem as a social issue and wrote a drama in 1894 called The Ghetto, in which assimilation and conversion are rejected as solutions. He hoped that the ghetto would lead to a debate and ultimately to a solution based on mutual tolerance and respect between Christians and Jews. By the way, the ghetto was his second stage of his thesis. Before he wrote The Ghetto, he believed that assimilation was the being similar to the nations would ultimately be the way to resolve the anti-Semitism. What ended up happening was, one thing which really changed his perspective completely was in 1894, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish officer in the French army, was unjustly accused of treason, mainly because of the prevailing anti-Semitic atmosphere. Herzl witnessed mobs shouting death to Jews in France, the home of the French Revolution, and resolved that there was only one solution, the mass immigrations of Jews to a land that they could call their own. Thus, the Dreyfus affair became one of the determinants of the genesis of political Zionism. Now, just to appreciate this for just a moment, just to the significance of this statement for a moment, is that Herzl was the same Jew who you'd speak to today and say, you know, if we were just a little bit more similar, you know, all that anti-Semitism, those Cossacks and those, you know, pogroms and what happened in Kishinev, and that was going to happen later on, all these things are in backwards, the backyards of Europe, you know, where, you know, the peasants who can't, you know, spell, put two letters together. That's why they hate Jews. In Western Europe, in sophisticated, developed society, where they're busy discovering radiation at this very moment, and where they're now inventing cures to unnamed diseases, they could never sink to the lowly, Jew-hating rhetoric which you see in that backwards Eastern Europe. And what shook Theodor Herzl was the realization that in France, the most integrated Jews, a captain in the French army who served his nation and state could be accused of treason. And the case went on backwards and forwards for years. And the articles and the riots, they went on because of this. He realized that ultimately anti-Semitism was not going to be solved by the theory of Nia Kagoyim. What a forward thinker, by the way. Now, his resolution, interestingly enough, to anti-Semitism, has not proved successful either. Because what he said was, when he wrote the Jewish state, Judenstaat, ultimately, when he wrote that, he believed that if Israel could be normalized as its own nation, they would stop being hated. But that's just, in a certain sense, globalizing the same theory, right? And today, we can see the results, is that we have a secular a Zionistic state, and are we loved by the nations of the world? Look at that. It hasn't worked out either. They still, everything that Israel does is seen under the scrutiny of multiple microscopes, while the rest of the world is still devolving into senseless civil wars. Right, so I understand that there's something which is clearly not arrived at even in history, but it's worthwhile appreciating the moment of epiphany in 1894, because why are we making the same mistakes in 2020? Why do we say now, as if we could just be a little more similar, if we're just a little less traditional, we take off those payers, we take off the garb and the hat, and we just settle down in the suburbia, and we stop talking about being Jewish all the time, maybe they'll respect us. If we stop believing in the nonsense they taught us in Hebrew school, maybe they'll... That didn't work. It didn't work then, and it doesn't work now. Just to appreciate this. Right, Jonathan Sacks has, in one of his books, he says, very beautiful description, he says that non-Jews are embarrassed of Jews, or embarrassed of Judaism, and proud of Jews are proud of their Judaism. Without thinking about it. It's not always the rule in all cases. There's something to be thinking about that. I'd like to conclude, perhaps, with this is less of a critique or a perspective on Seth Rogen, who's a wonderful actor who put together really a very creative movie. And I sincerely hope that he takes up the offer to learn from Rabbi Benjamin Blech, which is a fantastic opportunity. Rabbi Blech wrote a really, really beautiful letter to him. However, I really think that this is a moment for us to look inwards and to think about ourselves. Because, you know, it's all very nice to say them. To say, talk about the thems in society. Just appreciate the thems around us. Here in the Five Towns, going back 30, 40 years, was a conservative and reform bastion of Jewry. Right? Just to appreciate where we are right now. I had the opportunity a number of years ago. I was at a shiva house and I was chatting to a fellow who happened to be the youth director at Temple Beth El 30 years ago. Temple Beth El, which is down the road on Broadway. And just to appreciate this, at the time, it had 1,200 families. 1,200 families. That is three times the size of our shul, right? And I was speaking to him. I said to him, tell me, like, what was it like at the time? And he said, you know, the interesting thing was that the kids, when it came to the girls and the boys, and they reached Bar or Bat Mitzvah, at that time, they were only interested in synagogue up to that point because they needed to get through the bar to the bar of the Bat Mitzvah. Thereafter, they disappeared. They weren't interested. He talked about the struggle as a youth director to be able to motivate people who no longer had, so to speak, the carrot, which was being so to speak, you know, being hazed or being brought into Judaism by the bar and bar mitzvah ceremony. And Haraya, and unfortunately now, when you look at Temple Beth El, those 1,200 families are no longer here. Now, whether you say they're chased away by the Orthodox, those terrifying, traditional Jews who came by to scare them away from the Five Towns, whatever you say, then there's still are pockets of them. But predominantly right now, you know, Temple Israel to some degree has sold their building and now belongs to the JCC. Temple Beth El struggles for a minyan on Shabbos, and I don't say this in the remotest way of gloating. I say it in the most tragic way, because those 1,200 families. I would estimate, anecdotally, I would estimate that most of them did not go to other pastures to join other congregations. When those children moved away, they moved away further than even the Temple Bethel. We're looking at the tragedy of American Jewry unfolding underneath our feet, and we think in our little institutions and our little places of worship that Orthodox Judaism is so successful. A vast majority of American Jewry is disappearing by the day. That's a terrifying point. But we, not barring for a moment our discussion of our responsibility towards our brothers and sisters, it also should make us think about where we are on that trajectory, because we also straddle that world. We in the world of the modern Orthodoxy straddle the world of trying to be involved on the one hand in modern society around us and in traditional religion which enriches, engages, and challenges us. About society, the insulation and the openness that we have to struggle with on a daily basis. We struggle with the same ideas. It's worthwhile thinking about this. I'd like to just quote, and perhaps from a spiritual perspective, the works of Rav Reuven Sasson, who was originally in the name of the Chalban, but he has a very beautiful book called Hakitzu Veranano, which is Wake Up. It's talking about the Geula, and he says a very, very powerful thing. I'd like to read just a couple paragraphs, perhaps, in our learning. We'll conclude with this today. He says the following. This is the beginning of the Sefer, where he talks about what does galus mean? What does exile mean? We're in exile. What does exile mean? He says, "Hine galus Yisrael meratzom." When Israel was exiled from the land, he soyed hamisa. To a certain degree, it was like death. Kamavuar b'chazon ha'atzamosa yiveshos she'agalus hu peis hakvaros. Like Yecheskel, when he saw the valley of dry bones. In a certain sense, that's what galus is. It's the valley of dry bones. V'chein omrim chachamim nimshla tzion lemisa. In Babylon, when they were learning Torah, it was, so to speak, Kamesei Olam, the dead of the world. What happens when a person dies? Is their body biodegrades? The pieces, so to speak, separate from each other. And then slowly some parts disintegrate, some parts get separated. And what we're left with is living in a stage of aloneness, each person by themselves. Kishuv lo hayinu guf echad ela evorim merusakim. Ta'im nifradim zemizeh ba'arba ruchos ha'shamayim. We no longer live as the body of the nation. We live as little pieces, little cells here and there. He quotes the Gra in his commentary at the Sefer Tznusa at the end. But just before, without even getting there for a moment, just to appreciate what he's saying, is that when a person's alive and their body's alive, everything, it comes together. Everything coalesces. Their hands, their feet, their digestive system, their intellect, it's all working together. When a person dies, all those parts of the body slowly start separating and biodegrading. The flesh rots away, the muscles disintegrate and are eaten up, and the tendons, and ultimately all that's left is the bones. And he describes that in a certain sense, Knesset Israel went through that process where the vibrance of nationhood, the vibrance of what it means to be a nation as opposed to being an individual, disappeared. And all we could talk about was individuals. But yet, we still had structure. We still had, so to speak, the semblance of what that structure looked like. We had the skeleton. And that skeleton, so to speak, represented what was in the times when we had the ability to be able to fulfill all of the Torah in the place in the land of Israel. But then, over time, what happens is even the skeleton starts breaking up, right? So the bones, they get moved around, they're making a new highway, they're plowing through this area, right? And the bones get broken up. And so then what happens is you start having communities which has the femur over here and the humerus over there, right? This part of Judaism and this part of, so to speak, recollection of what it was living here. And that over there, you'll have, one of the vertebrae over there. And the, so to speak, little pieces of that community of what was are scattered around the world. And even further, the biodegradation process continues and the destruction process continues. And slowly, as he describes at the end, that all that's left, so to speak, is not even vestigial reminders or remainders of what we used to be a cohesive community. Now you have dust, so to speak. We're living in a situation where all we have is a little bit of cells. You know, like if you could scrape out of the mud, you get a little bit of the DNA of what that body used to be. That's where we're at now. There's not even communal structures in the same way. What he calls a hyper, what I would translate as a hyper-individualistic, so to speak, Jew who lives in an individual silo as opposed to thinking we or national descriptions. He goes on to describe, interestingly enough, there's many different pieces over here. He describes what this idea is, what he calls moichim de katnus. And what that means to say that we'll call it small-headedness as opposed to big-headedness. He says, hinei, Inyan chiyus hametzumtzemes, hisod mochim de katmus, hatoamim es matzoveinu begalus. We live in a, so to speak, a small-minded reality. Shubachinas is parados beguvlerisisim, which is like the body broken up into these pieces. Umochim elu, this mochim de katmus, this smaller perspective, hema chiyus shilarisisim anifrodim, is the, so to speak, the still the lifeblood left in some of the pieces. And our perspective, our lens through which we see our service of God is seen through this mochin de katnus. It's each cell, so to speak, each individual little piece serving God individually. Our livelihood is serving Hashem, she hamechaberes osanu elav yisparuch, which attaches us to the infinity, umamshichim bonu chayim v'kiyum, and gives us continued existence. So meshach hagalus lo yichle halizgalus bonu madriga hachayim hagdola shel haguf kula. We no longer have the full corpus of Knesset Yisrael, of the body, ko adam chay, like a live person, shenish masabi kibay, which has a soul in it. V'kach rak nitzotz dak. Shara, I call Aver, I call Talevoda. A little bit of life is left in each of the body parts. Limshach bo ma'at chayim leman yakum aguf l'tchias olamim. In order that should perhaps arrive at the end of time. Mochim dekadnus Elohim kumo adas shel hakatan shechoshev rak al atzmoi ve'en mesugol harchiv da'ato l'hargish es chayei ha'acher. This perspective is like a child. When you speak a child, they're very self-centered. They only think about themselves, about the next meal, about what they want, the next treat, the next incentive that they want. Right? They're only very self-focused. That's what's called mochim de katnus. That's where we are as a nation. We think about our personal portfolios in Judaism. We think about our personal advancement, if we're even at that stage, or think about our personal advancement spiritually. But we don't think in a larger perspective. It's fascinating, by the way. Like, you know, when dealing with Shul, and there's so many incredible, wonderful people. What's interesting is that a lot of the complaints come from a very, you will call it, individualized perspective. Is it doesn't work for me. I wanted this, and the perspective of Klal is not about me. The perspective of Klal is about us. Whether it be a shul, whether it be an American Jewry, whether it be Israel, whether it be all of the Jews around the world, even universally, all of humanity. We've lost that perspective of we talk. We don't understand our interconnectedness. A child only thinks about themselves, and that's where we are, spiritually speaking, even. Golos, exile, is like death and sleep. Therefore, redemption, meshula lekima me'afar uliyikitza mishena. Therefore, that's why what are the metaphors for geula is yikitza, the word kates, end comes the word yikitza, to wake up from shena, and resurrection, or kitzu verananu shochne afar. Wake up, be vibrant, those who live in the dust. And he talks about how the notion of being able to see more than ourselves. If you think about this, to me, this is so fascinating, because in a certain sense, we're witnessing this waking up process right now. We have been privy to a moment in history which our ancestors would have prayed and would have died for, to be here, to witness slowly the recalibration, the reconstitution of a nationhood as opposed to individuals. That's what's happening right now. Even though it began irreligiously and anti-religiously, that process itself is the process, so to speak, of the interconnectedness and the nationhood speak, which is necessary for the geula. It's worthwhile our thinking about this is because we live in a society which is hyper-individualistic, which has no perspective of greater sacrifices for greater good necessarily. We really are completely subsumed in the realm of convenience, the realm of, so to speak, self-serving. And if we don't recognize that from the outside, if we don't have the ability to have a meta-analysis of ourselves, then we don't realize that it seeps into our Judaism as well. And the more we're involved in the societies, the more we imbibe the notions of that society around us. And we fall prey in the same way as the many Seth Rogans of the world and the many other people in the world fall prey to, so to speak, the culture around them being the prime educator and forgetting, so to speak, the machtzavenu, our quarry, where it comes from. Our challenge is, at this critical time, is to be able to realize the little bit that we're holding on to is part of a greater whole. To understand that when we talk about Israel, it's not about whether or not we get the full perspective of the history of the last 80 years. It's about understanding the perspective of the last 3,300 years and making ourselves part of a larger and grander scheme of things. But as Hashem, we should have the opportunity that over time, that over the course of time, we remember these patterns. These are not new things that are being talked about now. These are things which the Gedolei Olam have talked about from time immemorial. And it behooves us to have a little more perspective of where our station is and perhaps what our lifeline is in order to be able to come out of this. And we should weep at the state of diaspora Jewry. At the same time, we should reach out our hands to ourselves and to those around us to appreciate where we're truly aiming for. And hopefully all of us, before it's too late, will be able to witness that geula shlema, that true redemption, bimheira v'yameinu. I thank everybody for taking the time. Obviously, this is a difficult topic, but it's something which is worthwhile considering.